You're listening to a Speech Therapy PD podcast. Earn 0.1 ASHA CEUs for this episode by completing the accompanying course online at speechtherapypd.com.
Welcome back to the Gestalt Get Together. This is a podcast recording where you're going to be hearing about Gestalt language processing, the autistic neurotype, the importance of musical language and psychoacoustics, as well as how our field is responding to the growing world of GLP discourse. Whether you're joining for an interview episode or a research deep dive, I am thrilled to be sharing my passion for working with Gestalt language processors with you. My name is Corinne Smoos, MSCCC SLP, and my aim here is to investigate things like psychoacoustics, music theory, musical syntax, the social engagement system in Gestalt language processors. There are so many great resources out there to learn about Gestalt language processing, natural language acquisition, but my true passion is to look into what's happening in the brain, especially when it comes to sound waves and when it comes to those little interactions that set the foundation for development in GLPs. I love Gestalt language processors. I work with them every single day. They're my entire caseload. I've had massive success using ideas from proposed frameworks like NLA, but I also identify myself as lovingly skeptical because I want more information. I want way more data and I want way more evidence to help build out this framework that I am so excited about. Now, I basically live in the journals. You don't want to know how many tabs I have open at any given time. One of my goals is to synthesize a lot of the exciting ideas from a range of different disciplines that can help inform our discipline, pulling ideas from language science, music science, neuroscience, psychology, pedagogy, even ABA, pulling ideas in, synthesizing them so that we can all grow our knowledge together and feel more confident working with Gestalt language processors. Tonight is an episode hosted by Speech Therapy PD. It is a recording for an hour and 30 minutes, and it's offered for 0.15 ASHA CEUs. Tonight's episode is about joint action and synchrony. As a listener to this episode, I hope you come away with a couple things, four things in particular. The first, I hope you come away with a working definition of joint action, as well as at least three examples of this. Maybe three examples I share, but I hope that you start to think about where joint action is in your life. And hint, it is everywhere, all day long. As speech language pathologists, we are typically pretty good at joint action and helping others to engage in joint actions. Something else I'd love for you as a listener to come away with is the ability to define synchronization. How do we synchronize with other people? And what are at least three examples of that? Again, you're probably doing it all day without even realizing it. As a listener, I'd be really excited if you could come away with working definitions of temporal entrainment and affective entrainment, or some people call it emotional entrainment, as well as be able to start to talk about how temporal entrainment and emotional entrainment contribute to pre-linguistic development. And finally, I'm hoping that you'll be able to come away with at least three techniques for how to enhance joint action and synchronization with the Gestalt language processors that you work with or the ones that you want to be working with. Because by bringing in enhanced joint action and synchronization opportunities, you're hopefully going to be creating better conditions for language acquisition, which is what we're trying to do here. So what is joint action? Joint action, like I mentioned, is something that we are doing all day. And once you start to notice where it comes up, you can't unsee it. At least I can't. Joint action is this form of coordinated social interaction where two or more people, but actually joint action happens a lot with animals too. So two or more people, in our case as speech-language pathologists, have a shared mental representation of a social goal. So in each of their heads, they have a shared mental representation of what they want to get done. And then joint action means that they have to coordinate with one another across time and across space. So here are a couple forms of joint action you may have engaged in recently, and I hope that you can think of at least one or two. of your own. One example of joint action is shaking hands with someone. You have a shared mental representation of what a professional greeting might look like in the setting that you're in. You both decide to cross a certain amount of space in between your bodies at a certain rate of your hand movements, not too fast, because that might be aggressive, not too slow, but this just right speed. Then you meet in the middle. You have the shared representation of moving your hands up and down a couple times with a certain degree of firmness, depending on the power dynamic between you. There's a lot of shared ideas that go into a handshake, but this is a form of joint action. It's a coordinated social interaction. Maybe you want to move your couch across your apartment or your house, so you ask your partner to help you move it. You're going to be engaging in joint action with a shared mental representation of where that couch is going to go. And hopefully you're able to synchronize well to each other to get that couch across the room without it landing on somebody's toe. But you have to coordinate across time and space. Now think about being in the clinic or working with a child in their home, maybe building a block tower together. You have the shared mental representation of stacking things on top of each other to create a representation of a structure. And maybe there's turn-taking involved, because if you're not engaging in joint action with that shared mental representation and moving across time and space in a coordinated way, that tower might get knocked over. You might try and put a block in the same place as that kid, and then kaboom, it falls down. Now, the kids I work with love when things fall down, so that can lead to another form of, you know, fun social engagement. But the joint action itself is the building and being able to take up time and space in a way that makes sense for that final goal. And then another one that I have been noticing more and more as more people in my life are getting married, joint action is when all of the, at least in the wedding traditions that I go to, where all of the single women reach up at the same moment and try and catch that bouquet that the bride throws behind them. This collective reaching up to try and catch something that is moving across time and space is a form of joint action. There's a shared mental representation of where that object has to go, what the purpose is, what the social reasoning is behind it, and there has to be coordination across time and space. So these are all forms of joint action that we might see in our lives. But joint action starts really, really, really early in life. And with the clients that we might be working with who are Gestalt language processors, they might need extra support to develop joint action skills and awareness of joint action to be able to reach those language goals that we have, you know, developed with their families and their teachers. So foundations of joint action that can one day lead to a handshake or can one day lead to catching the bouquet start in infancy. And where it starts is really at the emotional level and at the survival level between infants and their caregivers. And what's really cool, especially when I, you know, see it through my lens as a musical speech language pathologist, is so much of early joint action, at least laying the foundation for it, is musical in nature. Musicality is so clear in the qualities between a lot of caregivers and infants. Now, this is not true across all cultures. So many different cultures have different ways of interacting with infants. But when I think about where a lot of the research is derived from and the descriptions that I come across in the literature, the populations that are studied and described, musicality is really at the forefront of those early interactions between infants and caregivers. Things that were previously called mother ease, some people now call it parent ease, but a more technical term for it now is infant-directed speech. It has this slow tempo. There's repetition. There's this exaggeration in the prosody. And there's, you know, slow movements and this really kind of, there's a kind of like a smushiness in the way that infant-directed speech is presented, mother-ese, parent-ese, that is very highly musical. And if I were to give an example, let's pretend that there is a baby in my arms right now. I might talk like this.
Oh my goodness, you are just so cute. Da 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 da. I don't really talk to a lot of other people in my life with those same qualities, but there's this natural musicality that comes out when a lot of us are interacting with very, very small humans. There's inherent musicality there. And what's interesting is kind of, is it chicken or egg? Is it that we are primed to engage in these early communication behaviors with babies because they set the stage for later joint action? Because we are, without realizing it, engaging in skill building for these infants to help them become reciprocal social creatures? Or is this something that we've just learned to do over time by watching other people interact with babies? With most things, when it comes to humans, it's probably a little bit of both. But what's really cool is I want you to start thinking about these musical elements in infant-directed speech as what are called coordination enhancers. When I speak with a slower tempo, when I use repetitive rhythmic elements, oh my goodness, look at you. Da, 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 da. There's a lot of repetition in there and patterning. When I use exaggerated prosody, or when my face goes up, when my voice goes up, I'm trying to enhance the way that everything is coordinated together. My head moved up when my voice went up. Oh, that enhanced the message. Those two signals of visual and auditory were paired together quite well. There was a match there. So it's just very interesting that so much of infant-directed speech has this enhancing quality to it. These enhancers engage the infant's attention, and it also promotes emotional communication. Instead of staring at a baby and saying, "You are a baby. You are very cute. I love you," that doesn't really lean into the emotional side of it. But, "You are a baby. You're so cute. I love you." It's that push in, "I love you're so." And so those subtle changes that we can make with our voices, it really impacts the psychoacoustics of it. How do the acoustics impact the psychological perception of what we are saying and trying to communicate? We're laying the foundations from day one. And, some people do speak to their pregnant bellies. You could say even before birth, they might be getting even a muffled form of these coordination enhancers, which then hopefully lead to the joint action that we are working on later in life. Now, when infants start to respond back to that infant-directed speech, we call this communicative musicality. And this kind of interaction, that reciprocity, and we think about Gestalt language processors, at least for me, I am working on reciprocity. I want to build that back and forth. But it's really cool that so much of the foundation for this can be built in infancy. And so much of that communicative musicality builds on an infant's ability to predict timing. So much of this comes back to timing. When I'm talking about my framework of musical language therapy, it's all about timing and rhythm. And infants are learning about the world through timing and timing violations. What they're looking for are the timing of their parent or caregiver's expressions on their faces, the timing of when sounds come out of the mouth of this giant human who's holding me in a world that makes no sense to me. They're looking for timing in gestures, in flashes of light, and things are kind of blurry in the beginning. How do the sounds and the sights line up? And how do they line up based on what I, as an infant, just did? Is an instant, when I made a sound, did they make a sound right back? Those two things in close temporal proximity, there might be a cause and effect relationship there. Babies are starting to learn through this cause and effect so early. And infant-directed speech, or the musical language we provide early on, helps with that cause and effect. This coordination between infants and caregivers, this is interpersonal exchange that is all about contingencies. If this, then this. If this, then this. But if this, then this. And it starts so young.
infants and parents start to, and not just parents, all caregivers, start to predict each other's behavioral patterns. They start to predict each other's timing patterns, at least with typically developing kids. Now, this predictive power that they have on both sides, some infant and caregiver dyads are really good at this. They're really skilled at this ability to follow each other's rhythms, where some dyads aren't as skilled at this or aren't as attuned to one another. But this predictive power is crucial because it reduces the time lags and the processing lags in reacting to one another. And it's really essential for bonding. Now, a common example of this that I think is so helpful, especially if you as a speech language pathologist are going to want to be able to explain some of the ideas from this podcast and give a really concrete example, and it's peekaboo. That is the one I recommend using. Peekaboo is all about gentle violations of timing. So when you engage an infant in peekaboo, you naturally play with how many milliseconds they have to wait for that surprise to happen. They are predicting when your face is going to be revealed or when they're going to hear your voice say peekaboo. And even if you think that you are presenting your face and presenting that peekaboo moment at the exact same time interval, there's subtle differences there that are such rich information for that infant or that toddler to take in. Peekaboo is very, very powerful. And it's one of those things that, like, I, as an early childhood speech language pathologist, some of the things that we do in practice just look like playing, or they just look like games. But my goodness, if you really just look below the hood, this is serious brain work we're talking about. We're building their ability to process timing violations and timing lags and build that essential foundational skill for later joint action that can lead to, like, closing business deals and presenting in front of a crowd. All of those big things we think about start really, really young in those face-to-face interactions. I think what's also cool to think about is the game like peekaboo. The reason it can lead to laughter is because there's interruption of expectations and the ability to predict or not predict when something will be revealed, kind of like a punchline, can lead to that laughter. There's interesting thoughts around how laughter is actually like a low-grade fear response. It's a way of releasing tension after there's been a buildup of anticipation or fear. And that's kind of what a punchline is. Think about, like, a punch is, it's a kind of intense thing to call it if you think about what an actual punch is, but it's supposed to surprise you. So peekaboo has this impact of surprise and laughter. It really helps with prediction and timing. Now, when infants start to then show some agency over how they're responding to the caregiver, we call this musical action. And these are things like intentionally producing a vocal tone, like or engaging in some sort of rhythmic body movement. We see this within that first year of life. And what then happens between the caregiver and the infant is kind of this, like, sympathetic conversation between the two of them. And not conversation in terms of, like, hello, how are you, mother? I'm fine. Thank you, child. But it's this conversation that involves other information that isn't verbal in nature. These early conversations back and forth, they are absolutely reliant on the interpretation of timing and synchronizing to one another's nonverbal bids. There's anticipation, there's enjoyment between them, and they're really trying to line up information with one another, even though there's not a shared language between them yet. Turn-taking in infancy is turn-taking. It truly is. And it involves social cognition. It involves the need for so much attention and attunement. And we also see that this turn-taking often starts with a lot of imitation. Imitation in infants, we can see this in basic facial expressions. We see this in the mirroring of emotional sounds, kind of those, like, contours, We also see it in simple hand gestures and body movements. Imitation starts off pretty automatic, but over time, there's this subtle shaping into intentional imitation, and then imitation with some intentional differences on there. And that is often done to then make the caregiver laugh. So it's fun to see how that script is flipped once a typically developing child, or not necessarily typically developing, but a lot of the work and talk about early joint action synchronization is about typically developing kids. But we see things start to flip, and that's when a sense of humor also tends to emerge, is when a child realizes, oh, I can imitate you, but I can shift it a little bit too, and then catch you off guard. Kind of like their take, like reclaiming peekaboo on their own terms. But what we see is when infants and young children start to engage in goal-directed behavior with their caregivers, they're really starting to show early planning. They're showing more prediction skills, and they've got more representational abilities because they've got an idea in their head, a representation, and they can act upon it to reach some sort of simple social goal with their caregiver. Around the age of one, this becomes way more obvious for typically developing kids. You can see that they have a mental representation of the social goal that they have with you, and they're going to try and carry it out to reach that social goal. And a lot of these ideas, if you're interested in learning more, I recommend there's a really beautiful paper by someone named Philip Silver, and that is Phillips, Phillips dash silver, like the color. And this was a paper from 2012, and it's called Searching for Roots of Entrainment and Joint Action in Early Musical Interactions. I just thought it was a gorgeous paper that explains these concepts really well. And something interesting that also pulls from the Phillips Silver paper is talking about the different types of entrainment. So entrainment is this really cool biomusicological process where two organisms try to match up their rhythms to one another, or an organism tries to match up its rhythm to some sort of external rhythm, maybe from nature or from the environment. And we see this in kids. I think about, have you ever seen a young child start dancing before they even realize it? There's so many cute videos out there on the internet of kids who they're dancing, but they don't seem to be even in control of their bodies. The music is kind of making them dance. This is called groove. Groove is kind of that like psychological experience, the pleasure of dancing along to music, especially when you almost can't control it because the music is just the rhythm of it is pulling you in so much that your body kind of has to move along to it. It's really groovy. That's kind of the affective component of synchronizing to music and entrainment, is that grooviness, there's a lot of pleasure in it. And that's affect, emotion. We see this in infancy, but it really starts to come around in toddlerhood and early, you know, early childhood, when kids start to actually dance to the beat. As they get older, they can make choices about how their bodies move to music. They can make choices about how to engage in group dances that require social entrainment and collective decisions. Just like when sound, you know, sounds and babbling early on are more automatic, then as kids get older, they can start to make more decisions about how to move their mouth to reach a social goal. Now, a lot of what I'm talking about is with typically developing kids, because I want to set the stage of what these concepts are before I present some of the differences that exist in the autistic neurotype, and then very much so what we're doing in this kind of in the ecosystem of those of us who work with Gestalt Language Processors. We're kind of extracting ideas from the autistic neurotype to talk about GLPs, because so many of the GLPs we work with are autistic. Not all, but in my anecdotal clinical experience, most, if not all, GLPs that I've worked with are autistic. Now, early in life, we're thinking about how else can we build this ability to engage in joint action, synchronization. Musical activities are such a great way to do this. And I'm talking again about typically developing kids. I will move into ideas for autistic kids, neurodivergent kids. But for typically developing kids, musical activities are paramount for working on attention, working on coordination skills, starting to build the ability to hold mental representations, to then take joint action with other people and synchronize with them. Things like one-to-one music experiences, maybe playing a guitar to an infant. I've seen a really cute video of someone put their infant on top of a like baby grand piano and then was playing it so they could feel the vibrations. I've done tummy time experiences where I play guitar and maybe like the younger sibling of one of the clients I work with will hang out on the guitar while their older GLP sibling plays guitar. So there's really cool ways to have one-to-one music experiences that build joint attention and synchronization. But then group music classes are also really great for typically developing kids to build their foundations for joint action. Between 2.5 to 3.5 years old, musical coordination skills really just shoot through the roof. And this lines up to when we see language and grammar shoot through the roof for typically developing kids too. So you can see there's kind of a connection or a correlation between when musical coordination and musical skill burst and language and grammar skills burst. So much of musical joint action and the ability to share an idea with another human, a complex idea, and then take steps to engage in it requires what is called synchronization. So this episode is about joint action, synchronization. There's a lot of overlap between the two, but the ability to synchronize to someone, I want you to think about that as being able to line up your actions with them. And as kooky as it sounds, also kind of being able to line up your thoughts with them. Think about moving that couch with a roommate or your partner. You probably are trying to line up your thoughts with that other person who's carrying that heavy couch. I am always the friend who offers to help move. I love helping people move. I think for me, it is a form of heavy work and proprioceptive input that I am so grateful to have with a functional outcome. But, you know, I was thinking back when I was writing this episode to the most recent time I was helping someone move. And it was a third story walk up Baltimore townhouse, no elevator and a spiral staircase. And I was moving this couch up the stairs with someone that I didn't know very well, friend of a friend, also someone helping out. And I was really trying to read this person's mind. I was trying to pretend I was them because they were on the top, you know, they were on the top end. I was on the bottom end of the couch. And I was trying to sync up my timing with them, the rhythm of our feet on the staircase. So I was trying to bring music in, but I really was trying to line up my thoughts with theirs. And I was thinking about this anecdote and just thinking about what it must be like for a child who's trying to understand a social goal, understand whatever metaphorical couch they're trying to carry with their caregiver or this other kid at daycare or their therapist, and how strange it must be to try and read the mind of this other person who has so much more language than you. Lining up our thoughts and our actions is, we can refer to this as temporal entrainment. And we can also talk about it in terms of synchronizing to that other person. Can I line up with this person to not only accomplish a goal, but also to understand that person, understand their experience and where they're coming from? When it comes to typically developing kids, some of the recommended activities to help with synchronizing are things like clapping games. Clapping, working on clapping, it seems so obvious and simple. It is, at least in the part of the world that I'm recording this podcast from, clapping is a really important cultural signal. We use it in music, we use it in performances, we use it to get people's attention. The ability to clap your hands to a certain rhythm allows you to participate in society in pretty interesting ways. Early songs, group dances, all of these musical activities allow a child to develop coordination and synchronization skills with other humans, which gives them more opportunities to connect socially and try and understand the thoughts of others and line up their thoughts with others. Being able to precisely synchronize to others has a very slow maturation process. That level of precision requires so many interactions with other humans, predicting what they're going to do, assessing whether or not you synchronized or not, the fact that every single person you encounter has a different rhythm and their rhythm can change day to day, whether they're hungry or they're tired, whether they like you or they don't. Synchronization is quite an art. Now, there are two main types of entrainment that I would love for you to come away with as a listener to this episode. And I've mentioned each of them in passing, but I want to just give you firm definitions. So they are temporal entrainment and affective entrainment. Some people refer to affective entrainment as emotional entrainment, but I like affect because I think when people think emotion, they think of the extremes, like happy, sad. They think of a certain state. But when I think about affect, we all have affect all the time. So it doesn't feel as distinct or extreme. So I prefer to use that word when I'm communicating with parents or other therapists, because I think that there's sometimes misunderstanding that emotional entrainment only occurs or can occur when a kid is like really sad or really happy. We can be affectively entrained even for less perceptible emotions because we always have affect all the time. So, two types of entrainment: temporal entrainment, affective entrainment. Let's start with temporal. Temporal entrainment is when two or more humans are able to line up the timing of their actions to one another. So as time is passing, can I line up what my body is doing to what your body is doing with that, you know, temporal precision moment by moment? In music, this happens. We can see this happening because music is so much about the passage of time. And there's so many different periodicities in music to tap into. There can be how the melody is moving, the rhythm is moving, the overall structure of the song. And so temporal entrainment to music, we can feel this more readily. You can feel yourself kind of entraining to a very groovy song. I think about, for me, I experience immediate temporal entrainment to reggaeton. And if you've done any of my other trainings or programs, you are probably sick of me talking about reggaeton, but I'm telling you, it is like magic for Gestalt language processors. I use reggaeton with so many of my clients because it's so groovy and it is so easy to temporally entrain to. Our bodies just, the level of syncopation in reggaeton, our bodies want to be lined up to it. But what can be harder is that temporal entrainment to things like spoken language or just regular social interactions can be a lot harder because it's not as distinct how someone's mouth is moving for regular speech versus if they're singing something. Row, row, row your boat gently down the stream. You might feel that in your body as a listener, ba, 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 ba. But if I'm speaking more casually like this, you don't necessarily feel your body trying to bob along to my voice. It doesn't have as much regularity in spoken language, so it's harder to temporally entrain to regular spoken language. When it comes to music, we commonly start to engage in temporal entrainment to, you know, with behaviors like head bobbing or toe tapping, because the way that music carves up the passage of time is so much more obvious to us. It's so much easier to understand how music is separating intervals of time as we're experiencing it. Now, if we're thinking about really high levels of temporal entrainment, because when I'm giving examples, I love to give kind of simple examples and then really extreme examples. A simple example of temporal entrainment is tapping your foot along to a song. A high level of temporal entrainment would be in a group dance performance like the Nutcracker. If you're watching people perform the Nutcracker, you are watching top tier temporal entrainment of people who were probably really good synchronizers in infancy. Another low level of temporal entrainment that I like to give as an example is when you're walking next to someone. Maybe you're walking next to a family member or a colleague, and you look down and you notice that your footsteps have started to line up. You didn't do that on purpose, but you started to temporally entrain to them as you walk. Now, the other one, affective entrainment. This part, oh, I love affective entrainment. It is one of my favorite things to talk about and engage in with clients. And it's one of those things that gets me right in the feelings when I really think about it. Affective entrainment is the way that you can create and enhance interpersonal bonds with another human being and share emotion while you're moving with them. So when you're engaged in motion, and temporally entrained to another person, when your body movements are lined up, the emotional experience of that, that's the affective entrainment. This is, some people describe this, people who write about entrainment, they describe it as the joy of synchronizing your body movement to the body movement of someone else and the feeling of being connected to someone and being able to predict what they're going to do next. So much of life for all of us is not knowing what's going to come next and the anxiety that that can produce, or working really, really hard to make our lives more predictable, which can also create anxiety. And if you're not typically developing, or if you look at the clients in front of you and look at the anxiety comorbidities with autism, with ADHD, with Gestalt language processors, at least anecdotally, having caregivers or having a social world around you that is not as predictable must be really anxiety producing, especially if you've got language delays or language comprehension challenges or expressive speech challenges. And so one of the reasons why affective entrainment to me is so important is because if I can temporally entrain to a child who has a baseline level of anxiety, because the world is so unpredictable, if I can match up my body movements to them and I can make myself more predictable, they can then possibly experience the joy and the safety of knowing that at least one person in their life is a little more predictable. Because if I'm doing exactly what their body is doing, they can predict exactly what I'm going to do. And that takes out a lot of variables of trying to predict the future in a very sensorially overwhelming world. Now, what's really cool is that temporal entrainment, which is lining up body movements as time is passing, and then affective entrainment, which is that joy and interpersonal bond. And I'm being repetitive on purpose because I'm throwing a lot of content in here. There is an interplay between the two. And it's not just that temporal entrainment leads to affective entrainment. It's that there's also some people who write about this and think about this. They talk about how there's an intensification effect where the quality of the temporal entrainment, like how well and how precise you line up your movements to someone else, can intensify and enhance how much groove you feel with them or how connected you feel with them. And so the more precise you are, the more tuned in you are to exactly how your body moves, you can actually enhance the level of bonding you feel with that other person. And I know this to be true in my own experience when I'm working with clients. And if I am really temporally lined up with them, if I am copying the rhythm of their stimming, or if I am lining up items at the exact same moment they're lining up items, I feel that sense of connection with them. I feel that joy and that groove of their rhythm. So I feel that in my professional life, but I also like to talk about finding examples of these topics we talk about when it comes to GLPs in our personal lives as well. I think it can be helpful to find examples in our quote real life, makes these things easier to remember. So for me, every Wednesday night, I go to my dance class. It is non-negotiable. It is like sacred for me. This dance class, I remember the day a couple of years ago when I looked around and I was like, oh my gosh, this is what I've been researching. Because I looked around at this room of like 50 women Most of them I barely knew, from all different walks of life, from there's teenagers in there all the way up to women who must be in their 70s. And when all of our bodies are lined up doing the same dance, and it's a dance that we all know well, there is this feeling in the room. And there's this feeling in me, and I look around and catch the eye of these people whose names I don't even know. And there's this sense of groove and community, and just, I mean, it's really moving. Like, it is moving how we are moving together. And it's also really interesting when the kind of the opposite happens, when this in this dance class, we're all learning a brand new dance, and how confused and disconnected we all feel from each other because our body movements haven't lined up quite yet. Even though cognitively we know that in a couple weeks we're going to get there and feel that sense of interpersonal bond and affective entrainment, it's very disconcerting to not be lined up with one another with this shared goal. And I try and think about examples like that, and when I bring that into my clinical interactions, because for a Gestalt language processor who might feel so out of sync with the world around them, and even out of sync with their own bodies, can I or can we create more interactions that feel like that dance class, where there is a lining up, we are more predictable, we are more connected to help build those foundational skills that might be missing or delayed in GLPs? So, started to hint about some of the differences that we might see in Gestalt language processors, but I wanted to talk about another paper that specifically looked at entrainment in autistic individuals, and they looked at it through the lens of music therapy. The world of music therapy is a rich resource that I highly, highly, highly recommend looking into if you are interested in these topics. Music therapy researchers and clinicians are doing really exciting work when it comes to these foundational skills of joint action, synchronization, entrainment. And I think that our field has so much to learn from them and the way that they interact with autistic kids, especially Gestalt language processors, because musicality is so inherent to the way that GLPs communicate. And so this next paper is by Bharathi et al. It's from 2019, and it's called "The Potential Role of Rhythmic Entrainment and Music Therapy Intervention for Individuals with Autism Spectrum Disorders." So around 5 months of gestation, the circuits in the brain, the neural circuits for auditory memory, start to form. And there's this really amazing theory that this starts to happen. Auditory memory circuits start to form because that is when the fetus can start to sense the rhythms in the mother's heartbeat and the rhythms in the mother's respiratory patterns. Now, post-birth, every single child develops their own unique rhythmic patterns, especially their own unique motor rhythmic patterns. Those early patterns that are developing have an impact on the rest of that person's life of movement and movement-based communication. These rhythmic patterns of how their bodies move, which eventually inform how their mouths move if they're going to be speaking individuals, they are all of this rhythmic pattern development. It depends on their ability to perceive sensory input, to get feedback about that input, to entrain to their environment temporally, to affectively entrain to their environment. And it is the result of extremely complex cognitive and motor interactions with the people and the materials that they're interacting with, as well as just their relationships with their own bodies. And so for kids who are not typically developing, especially if there are autistic kids or GLPs who also have complex bodies in other ways, the ability to form rhythmic relationships with others and themselves can be impacted. Now, when it comes to the autistic neurotype, I've been touching on in recent episodes some of the widespread differences in the structure and the function of the autistic neurotype. Two areas that come up again and again as different in the autistic neurotype are the brainstem and the cerebellum. And there are developmental abnormalities in these two structures in the prenatal developmental period that are thought to lead to a lot of the sensory perception deficits that we see in autism and we see in gestalt language processors. Because of these sensory perception deficits, potentially related to brainstem and cerebellum structural differences, there seems to be less organized rhythmic patterns and less synchronization in infancy. Think back to what we talked about, the critical nature of that synchronization between infants and caregivers. But if you have a brainstem and a cerebellum that are inherently structurally different, the synchronization may be more difficult to achieve. Or early synchronization is A-okay, but then maybe around 6 months, 12 months, 18 months, the differences in that structure, there start to be more noticeable differences in interactions, which is why a child may seem typically developing up until a certain point. But then when certain skills we're expecting certain skills to emerge, the structural differences delay that or hinder that. And that is when maybe doctors or professionals or parents start to realize, wait a minute, you may not be typically developing. Now, in the autistic neurotype, there appears to be differences in two types of brain connections. Well, many types of brain connections, but the two in this paper by Bharathi et al. Are short-range connections and long-range connections. And both of these, we see differences in the autistic neurotype. So short-range connections, those occur within the same cortex. And then the long-range connections happen between different structures and even across different hemispheres. And the differences in these long-range connections or these long-range networks in the autistic brain, there are claims that those differences are really major contributors to the social communication and the social-emotional differences that we see in autistic processing. And so brainstem, cerebellum, interhemispheric connections, within cortex connections, there are inherent differences here. And I think that's so important to note because very often when I'm doing like coaching work or advocacy work, I hear things like, oh, they're just so stubborn, or why can't they just this, or language and rhetoric around that when it comes to an autistic kid. And what I try and bring it back to is, well, down to the level of the neuron, down to the level of, you know, their brainstem. And I like to make, you know, I put up my fingers to show how big that brainstem might be. They're working with different hardware. They're working with different hardware, working with different software. And so why can't they just, it's really not that simple. Their hardware, you know, might need different supports and intervention to be able to achieve that same goal. So I really try and bring it back to the neurology as best as I can, because for a lot of the GLPs I work with, it's not a matter of will. It's not a matter of being stubborn. It's not a matter of being shy or not wanting to. Or I've even had people, you know, talk about their, you know, the children that they work with, in terms of them being manipulative. And I like to bring it back to their brains are inherently different, and different supports and different interventions can help them thrive and make better sense of what you're asking them to do. So rhythm is the ability to organize time into distinct patterns. I like to think about rhythm because we think about rhythm as this, it's really fun. It's fun to experience rhythm. It's fun to listen to music, but rhythm has this really important function of dividing the passage of time up so we can make better sense of it. And if a child's body and brain has a reduced ability or an atypical ability to parse the passage of time, it's very likely going to have an impact on how they're able to move their body according to certain rhythms. Or when we think about gestalt language processors and autistic kids, how they're able to sequence movements and engage in speech gestures. And we think about kids who are non-speaking, dyspraxic, apraxic, and I cannot claim to be an expert in apraxia, dyspraxia, motor planning. That's an area of clinical practice for me that I have a lot of learning to do. It's definitely a clinical weakness. But what I do know is that the rhythmicity and the rhythmic differences in autistic kids in GLPs that are stemming from early synchronization difficulties, it's because of challenges parsing how to move muscles as time is progressing. Now, rhythmic entrainment interventions, which I'm excited to talk about, because of these differences in the autistic neurotype, the ability to train to others, when we think about rhythm, these interventions, the aim of them is to connect an autistic individual or a GLP with their own natural body rhythms and non-verbally connect them to the rhythms of others. Think very often, even in, you know, I think about my own attempts, even to this day, if I am not in the right headspace, if I am like not totally on the mark with a kid, I am catching myself trying to connect them to my rhythms rather than helping them connect to their own first, and something I try and work on every day. What rhythmic entrainment interventions can do is we're trying to notice and tap into the timing patterns that a child is already engaging in and experiencing, helping to build those, strengthen those, and make those more regular, rather than automatically trying to push them and form them into the rhythms of others, which would be things like trying to drill or train them to say a certain word or say a certain phrase, which would be matching up to someone else's rhythm, when on a fundamental level, they are still kind of lost in their own body and not really able to make sense of or have a lot of control over their own body movements. And so rhythmic entrainment interventions can be a way of helping them gain some more control over the way that they are moving their body as time passes, as well as making, when we make, help them make their body more predictable to them, we can hopefully also kind of reduce that level of anxiety through making their body movements more predictable. So when we think about rhythm, I think about bringing in things like music to sessions, or when I think about what we're going to talk about soon is mirroring and synchronizing to clients. We talked about synchronizing to infants, but I argue for synchronizing to clients no matter what age they are. Well, for me, I can really only speak to working with children. I don't work with those who are above preteens. But I argue for synchronizing way beyond infancy to help build those underlying skills. But using rhythmic entrainment and trying to match up with the movements of a GLP, it helps make you more predictable, but it also creates a sense of expectation because you're creating these structures in the passage of time. The passage of time may be very different for an autistic individual or a GLP, but when you're bringing in rhythm or you're bringing in music, you're helping time pass in a much more predictable way. And not necessarily by just having a clock available, but if you've got rhythm underneath, you're helping carve time into chunks. You're helping segment out the passage of time, which can then make it actually more mathematical. You're actually helping to bring in some sense of number and duration to the passage of time, rather than things that might be inconsistent. Like maybe if a child knows, it starts to realize that, oh, well, when my mom gets up from her chair and starts to walk towards the kitchen, then I think it might be time for the food to come out, which lines up to my stomach feeling hungry. There's so many different timing cues there that may not be precise and perfect and require so much more thought and cognitive resources for a neurodivergent child. But if you're using a song, then the duration of that song, the duration of the lyrics, the duration of the verses and the chorus is a lot more regular and easier to tap into. So it's this way of bringing in rhythm and making it easier for that child to entrain to what you're trying to communicate to them rather than them trying to interpret all of the subtle differences that are present in non-musical communication. Now, musical synchrony. We've talked about synchronization when it comes to infants, but I want to think about the ideas of musically synchronizing to a child on your caseload. And I think that a lot of these ideas can be really helpful if you're just starting to get started with bringing music into your practice. If you think about the kid on your caseload who is, and this, I say this word not about the child themselves, but more so about the therapeutic relationship, but like your hardest client. And again, it's not that the child is the hardest, it's that the therapeutic dynamic is feeling the stickiest. You know, the kid where you're like, I love this kid. I know so much about them and it is just not clicking. And I think most of us have a client like that. So I like to think about these ideas. Keep in mind that client for you, that GLP where you know so much about them on paper. You've got your toolbox of all the recommended ideas and you're just still, it's just not there. It's not there. You don't feel lined up to them. You don't feel in sync with them. And that is what this topic is really coming back to. Let's get back to the foundations. Maybe step away from the higher level stuff you're trying to work on. Can you get back to synchronizing with this GLP in front of you? And I recommend doing that through rhythm and music. So, what could this look like? This could look like entraining to the rhythms of their vocalizations. You know, I was just with a kid this morning who he's doing pretty well with his early grammar. I mean, he is presenting as if you are familiar with natural language acquisition or you practice with that framework, he would be considered a stage four GLP, early stage four. But he really, really enjoys vocal stimming. And so today we were doing pretend play with some peers at his school, and he was playing around with grammar as we were doing pretend play, and he got so excited and he started going, and it was interesting because his peers kind of like looked up at me to see how I would react because I'm new to the school. I've only been there a couple sessions, so all the other peers are still trying to figure out who I am. So they all looked up to see how I was going to react to my client's vocal stim. And what I did was I entrained musically and I synchronized with him. And because I've heard the digga 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 rhythm from so many clients over the years of practice, I was able to instantly click into that and do the digga digga diggas along with him. He looked at me with stars in his eyes because I entrained to him. And then these other three kids, I saw them all kind of relax because they saw me entrained to this child's musical rhythm and his vocal stimming. And I kind of normalized it as something or just treated it as kind of neutral. Because stimming, unless it's causing harm to self or others, is pretty great. It's a way of processing sensory stimuli or excitement or getting stress out. But I musically entrained to him and it seemed like he felt validated by it. His peers got maybe a message that his autistic communication or this, you know, moment, this quality of his of communication is neutral, if not fun and like sweet and a lovely thing. And it was one of those things that kept my client and I in that loop of feeling feeling connected and entrained to one another. I wasn't just reacting positively to the emerging richness of his grammar, but also this moment of deep excitement of digga digga digga, I was right there with him too. So that's entraining to vocalizations. But another area you can think about entraining is entraining to body movements. For a GLP you might be working with who is non-speaking, who may not make any sounds at all, you might be thinking, okay, well, how do I sync up if they're not making any sounds or if they're not stimming or speaking? I like to synchronize up to motor movements. And this can be things like rocking, walking, tapping, different play actions. I like to kind of step back with these kids who I don't feel connected to or as entrained to and think about, okay, well, what rhythms are you naturally working with? What are your natural rhythms? I was just talking to another speech language pathologist last week, and I was coaching her through one of her clients who feels exactly like this, that they are not synchronized. They're not lined up. They're kind of like missing each other. And as I was coaching her, she very casually in passing mentioned that the child engages in a back and forth rock and stomps her foot. And I said, whoa, okay, pause. Tell me more about that. Because to her, it was, you know, quote, just a stim. But to me, motions like that, where a child is self-imposing some sort of rhythm for very likely a self-regulatory purpose or because it's a pleasurable movement, to me, that gives us a window into a way to synchronize with them. They're already presenting with a rhythm that is serving some sort of purpose for them. And so then we can come in and kind of do two birds with one stone with it. One, we can validate that rhythm that they're engaging in. We can bring attention to it and show them that we're seeing it, which is really good, like visual confirmation of what their body is doing. And for a lot of autistic people who may not have a good body map or sense of their body in space, someone else copying that same motion kind of gives them a mirror. But then the other side of it is you're temporally entraining, which think back, could lead to affective entrainment, which is that interpersonal bond, that sense of connection, that sense of groove and joy. And so by temporally entraining to this child's back and forth stim, this rocking and the stomping, I see that as kind of a foundational intervention choice to build relationship with a kid that you just don't feel that click with. So instead of ignoring certain stims or writing them off or trying to extinguish them, I really like to see those as opportunities to better understand how a child is relating to their own body and to join them in something that feels quite natural to them. Our jobs are kind of resting upon asking kids to do things that aren't very natural for them. And so what I like to do is, at least in the very beginning, and for some kids, I've done this for years on and off, think of the kid with digga, 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 digga. That is, you know, that was a brief moment in our session that was so much more about the richness of grammar, but I hasn't, you know, and training to him temporarily like that hasn't really gone away. But for the kids where it just feels like something is missing, can you think about going back to these really basic things where you can line your body up with their body? Can you join them in something that actually feels natural for them in the later protracted pursuit of helping them learn something that you want them to do? Kind of lean into the rhythms that they have, join them there so you can build that bond and that relationship. And then once that has been built, start to move into the higher level stuff that, you know, is easier to write about on paper and, quote, looks better on paper. But I feel like if we're skipping that really important foundational connection work of timing and rhythm and entrainment, we might be hitting our heads against the wall trying to get to the higher level stuff because the early skills have not been fully developed. And their ability to understand you and what you want them to do is not necessarily going to be there because you're still quite unpredictable because you haven't entrained to them. Now, there's one more paper I want to share about, and this is once again pulling from the music therapy world. This is by Maury Hope, Fulsham and Mills, and it's from 2021, so a more recent one. This is about mirroring. The paper is called The Effectiveness of Mirroring and Rhythm-Based Interventions for Children with Autism Spectrum Disorder, a Systematic Review. So I was thrilled to find a systematic review. It looked at 11 different papers, all about mirroring. Mirroring, and you'll notice a lot of the terms I've mentioned in this episode have things in common, but they're just different ways of thinking about how humans relate to each other. Mirroring is when someone imitates the exact shape, form, feeling, or movement qualities of someone else's actions. So let me put that in clinical terms. Mirroring is when a clinician imitates the shape, form, feeling, and movement qualities of the child in front of them. Mirroring techniques are a really powerful way to build connection and rapport. And what we just talked about, the affective entrainment, if we're mirroring, we are temporally entraining to someone else. If we're temporally entraining to them, very hopefully and very likely, we're going to be affectively entraining to them. This systematic analysis found that every single study they looked at, all 11, they found benefits when therapists mirror autistic children. And when they look at using rhythm for social communication engagement. And so beneficial effects when therapists engage in that mirroring behavior with them. And the benefits that they saw were the following. They saw increased social gaze. They saw increased social touch, increased joint attention. And they even got reports in some of the studies that there were increased requests, verbal and not spoken and not spoken. And some papers reported new utterances and new phrases or single words at home. The statistical significance varied across the studies, but it was interesting that there were benefits across all 11 that they looked at. And so naturally, these authors recommended bringing in rhythmic mirroring into interventions with autistic kids. So by trying to imitate how that child is carving up the passage of time with their body movements and pretending, this is the way I explain it, is just pretend there's a mirror between you and that kid and act accordingly. It can have really powerful benefits. Now, before I talk about what I call my synchronization checklist, I want to make something very clear. Mirroring someone is vulnerable work. Copying someone, especially copying a child who might be engaging in behaviors or patterns that are not natural for you, it requires letting go. It requires being okay with feeling a little funny, feeling silly, feeling uncomfortable, and going against your own movement patterns. We all have movement patterns that are so ingrained in us and natural to us. And when I'm asking you to mirror someone else, I'm asking you to break those patterns, try out new ones, and do things that are probably going to be very uncomfortable. I love mirroring kids. I do it all day. And there are still many moments when I feel so strange because just before this episode was recorded, I was laying on my back underneath the ceiling fan, making my head go in a circle because my client was laying on his back and his eyes were following the ceiling fan's movements and his head was going in that circle too. And it felt different for me. It was a movement pattern I've never done before. But because I was mirroring him, because I wanted to temporally entrain to him, because I so, so want to affectively entrain with him because he is one of those kids who we haven't had that click yet. Even though I know so much about him on paper and I have every tool in the toolbox I should, we don't have that affective entrainment, but I was doing the mirroring and it felt a little funny. So I like to give that heads up. You're going to have moments that feel funny. And at the end of the day, at the end of all of these years of feeling funny, my goodness, it is so, so worth it because I have GLPs who look at me with just this shock and excitement that my body is doing what their body is doing, that I'm perceiving the world and I'm noticing things that are important to them. That ceiling fan was so important to that kid. So I was right there enjoying the motion with him and I was getting to see it from a new perspective. On my own, I would never move my head and my eyes that way while looking at a ceiling fan. But I got to perceive that information in a brand new way. And I actually got to feel the underlying musical rhythm of the ceiling fan. I never would have noticed that. It says, I got to feel the rhythm of that motion because I was joining the rhythm of my client. And we had this little moment where he very slightly turned his head and made very brief eye contact with me while I was mirroring him. It was kind of like this little window into affective entrainment. But that is my heads up. There are going to be moments that feel very funny and very strange, but it's so worth it because we're building these foundational skills of synchrony and joint action. So I mentioned a synchronizing checklist. These are questions I like to ask myself with clients with whom I do not feel that click, or I just feel like something's missing. So I ask myself these questions, and if the answer is no, I adjust accordingly. And this is a work in progress always. This is why we call it clinical practice. I am practicing these things. In training to someone else and copying them is really tough. It's a lot of work. And I think that doing this kind of synchronization and entrainment work is a really good window into how hard our clients have to work to change their motor patterns and behavior. And I'm a fan of any clinical experience that humbles me and shows me how hard my clients are working to learn this new stuff. Question one of my synchronization checklist. Am I mirroring my client's posture? So I step back, I assess, what is their posture? Can I mirror it better to the best of my ability with a body that is much older than theirs and has a lot more aches and pains than theirs? And all of these questions, it is to the best of your ability, considering what your body is capable of doing and any differences you might have physically. Question two. Am I mirroring this child's vertical level? So what does that mean? Are they above me? Are they below me? Are they flat on the ground? Are they up on a chair? Can I try and mirror that vertical level? That's something I have had to make a lot of behavioral changes about, because early in my practice, I would find myself always being above the child. And that's not very well synchronized, because that means they have to tilt their head to even notice what I'm doing. So I'm thinking about, am I at the right vertical level with them? Question three of synchronizing checklist. Am I mirroring the child's head position? So their head tilt, are they looking up? Are they looking down? Are they investigating underneath a table? Or are they side-lying and lining things up? I will also try and mirror the head position. Again, I'm trying to imagine, if there is a mirror in between us, what would I need to adjust to make my body look like theirs? Okay, the fourth question is one that surprises people, but anecdotally, and my clinical, longitudinal, anecdotal acquisition of data, this one makes a big difference. Am I mirroring this child's breathing tempo? Our breath is a really important biological signal to others about safety. And it tells others if we're calm, if we're stressed. And it's another really cool, subtle way of entraining and mirroring someone else. So I will try and imitate the breathing pattern of my client, especially if they are an audible breather. And that way, if they can hear themselves breathe in or breathe out, and then they hear me breathe in and breathe out at the same time, it's kind of this acoustic pairing up. Now, if you can hear them breathing, there are probably other, if you can hear them breathing like more often than not, there's probably other things you might want to refer out for or look into, but that's a whole different episode. But just start to notice, if this child is taking low, slow breaths, and you're breathing a little more rapidly, maybe because you're anxious, because the session isn't going well, it might be a cue for you to mirror that breathing rate too, so you can give them a cue that you're with them, you're calm. It's also a great way to help yourself calm down. The next question I might ask myself is, am I mirroring this child's level of energy? Now, if we're thinking about like a floor time approach, we don't necessarily want, we might want to go a little bit above or a little bit below based on helping them stay in a zone of learning. I also am not going to be mirroring a child's level of energy if they are destroying the clinic or if they are falling asleep. But in a general sense, are you kind of with them in terms of their energetic output, as if there's that mirror between you? There are, modifications and considerations here when it comes to safety and staying in a zone of learning versus getting really overwhelmed or super under aroused. But in a general sense, are you with them in that same range of energy? Next question. Am I mirroring this child's tempo of stimming? Tempo is like how fast or how slow a certain like period of information is happening across time. So like this would be a fast tempo. A slow tempo would be da 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 da. So if a child is engaging in some sort of stim or some sort of method of playing that has a tempo, are you also working at that same tempo? So the example I give is if a child is lining things up in a classroom or a clinic or in their home, can I also line up different items in my own line? I might, more often than not, I'm not messing with a child's line for a reason I'll talk about in a couple checklist questions down. But am I trying to stim with them or kind of engage and play with them at the exact same tempo? Again, thinking there is a mirror in between us. The next one I want to ask myself is, am I mirroring this child's vocalizations or their gestalts with fidelity? How's my pitch? How's the timbre of my voice, my rhythm, my tempo? A big thing that we do with stage one gestalt processors is if they say a gestalt or a song lyric or a movie quote, it's really important to acknowledge it back or repeat it back. Not in all situations, but in a lot of them. But am I mirroring that vocalization or that utterance with fidelity? If they say maybe a, let's see, I'm thinking of a recent gestalt I've heard. I have a client who loves Transformers lately. And so he will say when he's about to leave, "Autobots, roll out." But if I acknowledged back and said, "Autobots, roll out," that doesn't have a lot of fidelity. With the original utterance, I would try and say it back in a similar way with the same timbre of "Autobots, roll out." And this way I'm mirroring the acoustic qualities. They're going to be easier to recognize by that child because they're more closely imitating the output that they just provided me. The next question I might ask is, am I mirroring this child's attentional focus? This is one I constantly have to work on because I have to think about, what is this kid paying attention to? And it might not be the thing that I think they are. They might be playing with a toy down on the ground or like investigating some sensory phenomena. And I might maybe making assumptions about what they're paying attention to based on what I would be paying attention to in that situation. And so if I'm feeling like I'm not synchronized with a kid, I kind of step back and think, do I actually know what they're paying attention to? And the answer is often no. But if I kind of like shift my position, my posture, my vertical level head position, or I just take a breath and like do a little reset, I realize that they were attending to an element of the scene or the toy that I wouldn't have even thought of. Maybe like the shininess of a piece of metal on the toy car, or the stem of the toy apple rather than the apple itself. And so that's a way I can help myself synchronize better is by just reassessing, are we paying attention to the same thing here? The next question that I'll ask myself, and this speaks back to the lining up, is am I mirroring the child's play choices, but with separate but similar items? And if you've heard me speak before about play, I use this phrase often. It's a phrase that I found is helpful when people keep getting rejected or pushed away, or children become upset that you're trying to join their play. Separate but similar. The example I can give for this is when a child is lining things up, because a lot of GLPs will line things up. One of the worst things that I have done early on, before I knew what GLP was, I would try and join in and play with the toys that the child was lining up, or I would add other items to the line that weren't part of the set in that kid's mind. And now I do not do that. I find items that are separate but similar. So if they're lining up wild animals, I am not necessarily going to line up my own animals. Those are separate from their set, but they're kind of the same. And that might feel kind of threatening to the play. It might feel too close. I kind of like to do something similar. They might, what I'm saying is that if they're lining up wild animals and I get out a different wild animal set, they might want those for their own line. It's too close. It's too much within that original kind of cognitive gestalt of wild animals. And that might feel too threatening or like, no, 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 I need those too. So what I like to do is find something similar. So I might get a set of like aquatic animals, or I might get a set of dinosaurs that don't fall into the concept that the child is playing with or acting out. It is a separate set, but it has similarities. And that way, there's not necessarily that threat response or an encroachment. I'm not trying to get in on their play and mess with it, but I'm pretending that there's a mirror between us. I'm copying their actions, but not with items that they might think, no, 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 I need those for mine. So that's a phrase I'd love for you to take with you and try on, is separate but similar. And the last one that I need to ask myself, and this is really about staying, you know, staying attuned and staying connected, which is really hard because we have one of those jobs where we have to leave all of our stuff at the door. And we've got to balance being in the present moment with a lot of paperwork and goals and different people having different desires and opinions and school systems. And there's so much that goes into our jobs that can pull us out of being attuned. So last one I asked myself, if things are feeling off and unsynchronized with the GLP, is, am I actually experiencing the present moment with this kid? Or is my brain on a different plan, their IEP goals, their IFSP goals, something else? Am I hungry? Am I tired? Am I worried about this kid's future? Am I worried about the session that happened before this? So that is a question I ask myself. If I feel like I'm mirroring them really well, but I'm just not clicking with them, I come back to, am I actually in this present moment with them? And like when all else fails, that is usually the reason, is that at least part of my brain is somewhere else. And this is where we get into like the really nitty gritty hard stuff of doing the child, you know, child-led approach and the play-based approach. You got to be really, really present and attuned. And very often that takes, you know, some really important work on yourself and like being in your own body and being very present and setting aside what might be like really powerful thoughts that are trying to come in and take over. But I find when I am extremely present and attuned with a GLP, it is so much easier to synchronize with them. It is so much easier to temporally entrain to them. And then it is easier to affectively entrain them. Now, the final thing I want to do is throw out a couple of ideas, kind of just a couple of synchronization ideas to just put into your toolbox to try out. And these can help enhance the rhythm, the rhythms that happen in your sessions, and they might catch your GLP's attention. One way to try and synchronize or bring in more music, throw in your toolbox, is try tapping your foot or tapping your hand while you're modeling something. If you're modeling a potential gestalt, maybe tapping on your leg while you model it or tapping your foot underneath. This could be a fun way of trying to encourage some synchronization from them and bringing more pattern and rhythmicity to what you're saying. You're helping carve up time a little bit differently. I also experiment with clapping or snapping while I model potential gestalts, especially to stage one GLP. So I might snap along or clap along. That snapping and clapping helps to break up the passage of time a little bit better, and it might make it easier for that child to temporally entrain to you and feel the groove in what you're saying. Something else in my toolbox is I like to move therapy materials, whether that's a therapy, a swing, or a toy, to a steady rhythm. Instead of just taking a car and going vroom, 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 I might take the car and go vroom, 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 giving that kind of steady backbeat or that steady rhythm. It might make it easier for that child to synchronize with you and entrain to you. Another one that I do often is, especially in a bigger clinical environment, or if you're working with a child outside or in a hallway or whatever setting you're in that's bigger, if they're walking or running, try to walk or run with that same tempo. At the beginning of the episode, I talked about when you're walking next to a friend and your footsteps unintentionally line up with one another. What if you intentionally did that with your client? I've had really special moments of kind of that click or connection with one of my quote, hard clients. When I line up my footsteps with them or I run at the same pace of them and they look up at me like, oh, you're not that bad after all. Another one I really love that I've been using more and more lately is actually drawing or scribbling to a rhythm. There's something really captivating about watching someone draw. And I especially use this if I have a GLP who is having a really hard time, maybe is really tired, having a tantrum, is upset. I'll start scribbling or drawing to a certain rhythm, like as I'm drawing. And it's this really cool way of kind of meeting in the middle and sync. They kind of synchronize to the motion of my pen or my marker, and it can be a really good connection point. And then another one that you might want to try experimenting with. This is not a technique that I find helpful for me because of I find it hard to be able to focus on modeling and staying present. But there are plenty of speech therapists I've worked with who say that this method works really well for them. And that is playing what's called a metronome in the background while they're working with a child. And a metronome holds a steady beat, like a And some speech therapists, especially those who don't have musical training, they find that to be really, really helpful to help them pace their movements and model along too. And then for some children, that metronome is actually a really helpful, almost like acoustic support system to help them move their body or communicate in more patterned ways. So those are a couple things to throw into the rhythmic and synchronization and mirroring toolkit. And now we have come to the end of the episode. We've talked a lot in this episode about a bunch of interrelated topics. Some of those are joint action, synchronization, temporal entrainment, and emotional entrainment. I gave you my checklist of questions to ask yourself of when you're trying to synchronize to a Gestalt Language Processor or autistic child. And then I threw in a couple of synchronization ideas for your toolbox to try out. I hope that you've come away from this episode with some definitions, things that you want to look into more, and at least a couple ideas of things to try, especially with those Gestalt Language Processors where you're just not quite sure what isn't clicking. I hope that by bringing in synchronization and rhythmic entrainment, that you can start to feel some of that interpersonal bond intensifying through affective entrainment. Thank you for all the kind words in the chat. I appreciate it. Oh, there is one in the Q&A. Oh, okay. Cassidy asked, how long do you typically use the mirroring approach? Just until you feel as though you click with the client? How do you balance mirroring and introducing new gestalts or new learning opportunities? Oh, awesome questions. Okay, so how long do I typically use the mirroring approach? I really, for some kids, I never stop because depending on their regulation, some kids week to week, they will be more or less entrained with me. Let's say they had a really like high burnout week at school, or they weren't sleeping well, or you know, nutrition was low. I'm probably going to be more so in a mirroring session to get that trust and connection and foundation back, because I know that they can't access the higher level stuff. For some clients, I'm mirroring for, couple months, because maybe they haven't had an experience with an adult or a therapist where they've had an opportunity to build all that foundational skill and build those, networks in the brain. And so we're going to spend a couple months doing that. Balancing mirroring and introducing new gestalts. Oh my gosh, that is like the question, right? And that is something that I'm working on every day to help to find that balance. What I like to do, kind of as my rule of thumb, is mirror, mirror, mirror until I get that like ding or that moment of eye contact or like aha, then I'll introduce a new gestalt. So I'm mirroring until I know that we're connected and we've got that affective entrainment. And to me, I kind of imagine that like the elevator doors open and then it's like, boom, potential gestalt. But if I'm modeling potential gestalts when I don't necessarily know that we've got that click or that affective entrainment, I don't even know if they're processing the sound waves that I'm producing because they may be so focused on something else happening in the environment. So mirror, mirror, mirror until you've got that like what it Marge Blanc calls it, like bingo eye contact. I think that's one way of putting it, but kind of like that click, or you feel kind of like the flow of information between you. So like nonverbal flow of information, that's kind of that moment to just be like, whoop, layer on top of a potential gestalt. But great question, because it's one that I have to think about every single day. It really is a dance of finding that perfect moment. All right. Guys, thank you so much for joining. I really appreciate it. And I really hope to have you back for another podcast recording. And if there's any topics you would love to learn more about, please feel free to reach out on Instagram to let me know so that I can do more research and write episodes about the things that you want to learn about. All right. Take care, everybody. Thanks so much for caring about GLPs. Means the world.
Thanks so much for joining us on today's podcast. Remember to go to speechtherapypd.com to learn more about earning ASHA CEUs. We want you to get credit for the hard work you've put in to further your education. We also appreciate your support. We'd love for you to write a quick review of the podcast and subscribe. If you're listening on a streaming platform, feel free to rate us. 5 stars is great, 4 stars is awesome, but we also appreciate honesty around here if it's lower. That way, your ratings and your reviews will help get our podcast to more clinicians like you, as well as parents and people from other professions who might benefit from learning about Gestalt language processing. Now, if you've indicated that you are part of the ASHA registry and entered both your ASHA number and a complete address in your account profile prior to the course completion, we will submit earned CEUs to ASHA for you. Please allow 1 to 2 months from the completion date for your CEUs to be reflected on your ASHA transcript. And also, please don't hesitate to tell us which topics you would like us to cover in future episodes. To get in touch, drop us a line in the comments section or send us a message on social media. We'd love to hear who you want us to interview, what topics are on your mind, and where you'd like us to investigate when it comes to the world of GLP. I hope to see you at our next episode.
Remember to visit speechtherapypd.com to earn 0.1 ASHA CEUs for this episode and to see our library of over 1,400 courses for all things SLP.